It's time for the
What in the
podcast.
Point Pleasant, West Virginia has a long history of high strangeness, dating back to the Spanish-American War, when a Native American chief, betrayed and killed by the American military, enacted his dying vengeance by laying a curse upon the land. Fast forward to two November evenings in 1966, involving an encounter with a stranger from the stars and a mysterious bird-like creature who plagued the town of Point Pleasant until the collapse of the Silver Bridge in December of 1967. The creature now known to everyone as the Mothman. Welcome to episode 139 of What in the Podcast.
Begin audio transmission.
Welcome to the What in the Podcast with your hosts, Kent Whittington
and Adriana Comito
and Tracy Lynn Hernandez.
The What in the Podcast.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hiya.
As you can tell, Adri's back with us tonight.
Adri's back.
How you doing, dear?
I'm alive. For a while there, I was wishing for death.
Yeah, well, Speaking of death, how'd you guys survive the apocalypse?
I survived.
Yes.
Apocalypse?
The eclipse. On the 8th.
The rapture. Yes. You know.
It was supposed to be, the rapture was supposed to happen then too. Although there's been an update, the latest internet
who's missing?
News says the rapture will actually occur on April 23rd. So get ready, folks.
I wonder how many people have the shirts that says I've survived the, and you fill in the date and it's all scratched out in red ink all the way down their shirt. Apocalypse, you know, or rapture.
Wasn't 2012 supposed to be the end of the world too, but Mayan calendar or something?
Yep, yeah, Mayan calendar hit the end of its cycle, but that's the end of its cycle. It
seems
again.
The Mayan calendar is, their cycles are cyclical anyway. And what people don't remember is that they'd have a so many year calendar and then they'd start over again with something else. Well, it wasn't the end of the world. It was just the end of that era.
Well, do you remember, I can't remember the guy's name. Do you remember the guy who predicted the end of the world right around the same time, 2012?
No.
It's not Nostradamus, but so, yeah.
No. This guy is in our era, not back in Nostradamus' time. But no. My whole joke about that when it happened was that he forgot to carry the one when he predicted his date.
Yeah.
So, maybe better luck next time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we are actually offset a week now because we did not get our interview last week. I didn't really go into too much detail about our guest, but he was in the hospital for a little while. Something major, but he's doing better now. We're going to give him about a month to recover, and then I'll try and get him back on the show after that point in time.
If he's up to it.
If he's up to it, yeah. No pressure.
So
here.
Won't it be?
Mm-hmm. Also, positive ghost stories. I wanted to bring this up. I got a lot of feedback after I posted on a couple of Facebook groups.
Okay.
And got some responses. So I'm compiling
Yay!
These and hopefully we can get some people on and talk to them about their ghost encounters.
Yay! So, ghost stories.
Yeah, so good things.
I'm always for that. Trust me.
Mm-hmm.
I love hearing the stuff.
It's just shenanigans and we're always up for shenanigans.
It's some antics and we're always up for semantics.
That too.
That's you didn't do it right this time. That's why I'm picking on
that
you.
That was deliberate. I gave you the opening.
Oh gosh. I've married a ham.
Did you say semantics or some antics?
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Exactly. Sorry. I'm feeling a little bit better in case anybody couldn't tell.
Well, that's pretty obvious. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tonight. Our subject is something that I actually have been avoiding for a while because everybody does it. And I wanted to get into find more out there stuff, more obscure things, maybe something nobody's really heard much about. But I think we're at that point now to where we have to actually start talking about some of this stuff.
I found some stuff for my mind that reminds me of my podcast.
Well, that's great. You got something for your podcast. Can't find anything for this one, though, can you?
Wasn't looking.
The part where we haven't actually done our podcast
yes, in a while.
Well, that's no excuse.
Yeah, it is.
I'm going to get in trouble if I keep talking.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Keep digging.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're back.
No, you're not.
Sorry.
So anyway, the subject tonight, we're going to be talking about the Mothman. Specifically, the Mothman, his connections to Indrid Cold, the Silver Bridge collapse.
The first one I couldn't
you
hear.
You don't know Indrid Cold?
I couldn't hear you.
Indrid Cold.
Oh, no, I couldn't hear. I couldn't tell what you were saying because my hearing is really
bad
right now.
And the curse that was put on the land by an Indian chief.
Cool. That you don't hear of as much.
No.
The Indian chief curse, I haven't heard of that one yet. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I just haven't heard it yet.
So
not in concurrence with the Mothman.
Any other new business before we start?
Hug your friends close. Hug your family close. Make good memories. And yeah.
Tomorrow is not a guarantee.
Especially with the rapture on the 23rd.
That is not what we're talking about, and you know it.
I know.
And I say again, how many people have the shirt saying, I survived this date, that date, this date, that. That'd be a cool tattoo.
Blank.
Get, you know, yeah. Start back from Nostradamus' age, when you go through there and have to put down the dates of each of the raptures into the world.
Every
and keep adding.
Talk about
what
a,
I down
said,
the arm.
Yeah, talk about a
what
snake tattoo.
What I said was, when he said, every yeah, said it was the rapture, I said, yeah, every time there's eclipse, some culture somewhere on this planet thinks it's the end of the world. And from the very, you know, from way back in caveman days.
Yeah, but we're talking about educated people who should know better. They still see signs.
I hate to say this. And the rapture isn't in the Bible.
No, it's
you
not.
Said it's not in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. I don't remember reading about the rapture in the Bible.
No, the end of days are there, but there's no talk of an actual rapture.
Yes.
Rapture is actually a fairly new concept. We could do a whole episode on the rapture. But
we probably should.
Maybe.
But that's like borderline political at this point, too.
And we try to avoid
and
that.
You're talking about educated people. When religion pops in, education goes out the window.
This is true. This is true.
And I'm not against religion. I go to church, okay? I am not anti-religion. But my point is, when people start bringing in religion, education tends to go out the window because they start panicking.
You realize that makes you either someone that the religion doesn't want, or the person who's going to become the cult leader. She's smiling.
Dun, dun, dun.
You have plans you haven't told us about?
No well, plans.
Sure you haven't.
Okay. Maybe a happy accident in the future. Who knows?
Happy accident.
Yes, sure. I am a smart ass.
Sure, the bishop is going to have a terrible fall or something like that. Yeah.
No, I didn't say anything about that.
Great spring, though.
No, I don't know the current bishop. Okay, I like our friend the bishop. So no, we're not going to have that one.
We like Bishop Rake. Let's leave her alone. We like her. Let's not do anything to her.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, let's just jump right into it. After however many minutes we've been talking. So, Mothman in West Virginia folklore is a humanoid creature reportedly seen in the Point Pleasant area from November 15, 1966 to December 15, 1967. The first newspaper report was published in the Point Pleasant Register dated November 16, 1966, titled Couples See Man-Sized Bird Creature Something. The National Press soon picked up the reports and helped spread the story across the United States. The source of the legend is believed to have originated from sightings of out-of-migration sandhill cranes or herons. More on that later.
Wingspans.
Something tells me that a crane and a heron do not look like... Anywho.
No, but it's the wingspan.
Well, yeah.
They have really big
monster-sized wingspans.
Yes, they do.
And tiny little bodies. So, yeah.
Okay, so maybe not more on that later.
Sorry,
So the creature was introduced to a wider audience by Gray Barker in 1970 and was later popularized by John Keel in his 1975 book, The Mothman Prophecies, claiming that there were paranormal events related to the sightings and a connection to the collapse of the Silver Bridge. The book was later adapted into a 2002 film starring Richard Gere. Did you guys see that one?
Yes, it was a very good movie. I liked
it. I did.
I saw it.
But it's been a few years since 2002.
Didn't it come out the same time Dragonfly did too?
2002. Yeah, about the same
time. About the same time or similar time. But I preferred that movie because I liked that.
Well,
but
the Mothman Prophecies, the movie wasn't completely accurate to what was going on
in the books and everything. Yeah, that's part of why.
Part of movies.
That's all.
Yeah, that's Hollywood for you.
So also I wanted to point out that an annual festival in Point Pleasant is devoted to the Mothman legend now. It's celebrated annually, except during COVID, of course. Mothman sightings, although the most popular Point Pleasant's oddities, though, are not the beginnings of the high strangeness in the vicinity. Who would like to talk about the first incident?
I don't have my phone up. Sorry.
You're terrible.
Yeah, I'm absolutely horrible.
Should I just keep on reading?
I can read it. I had to get it to scroll to where it was supposed to be because I had to blow up the print. And yeah, therefore I lose things quickly.
See, folks, we work together, sort of.
Maybe.
Yay, so cooperation.
We have here events in Point Pleasant prior to the Mothman sightings, Chief Cornstalk and the Curse. Fighting Chief Cornstalk, 1720 to 1777, was a prominent leader of the Shawnee Nation just prior to the American Revolution from 1775 to 1783. His name, Hokolesqua, thank you, translates loosely to stalk of corn in English, and is spelled Kolesqua.
Kolesqua?
Kolesqua.
Kolesqua.
Yeah, you know what? I have terrible pronunciation for not French and English. So, anywho, in some accounts, he's also known as
You're on your own here.
And oh my goodness,
Winnipegsika.
Sika, yeah.
So I do not have any Shawnee in my blood, my background. So I apologize because it's not the language that I need to learn to speak, but it's the language I need to learn to speak.
Well, we're just going to call him Cornstalk from here on out.
Yes, thank you, because that would be easier on my trip of tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Cornstalk opposed European settlement west of the Ohio River in his youth, but he later became an advocate for peace after the Battle of the Point Pleasant in 1774. His murder by American militiamen at Fort Randolph during the diplomatic visit in November of 1777 outraged both Native Americans and Virginians.
Mm-hmm.
Artist Bob Roach built a statue of Cornstalk, which is located along the Ohio River flood wall in the town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, alongside other historical figures associated with the area. In the early years, historians believe he may have been born in present-day Pennsylvania with his sister Nonhelima, moved to Ohio country near present-day, God bless it, Chillicothe?
I'm not sure about that. Chillicothe? It could be Chillicothe. Yeah, probably Chillicothe.
When the Shawnee fell back before expanding the white settlement. Stories tell of Cornstalk's participation in the French and Indian War from 1754 to 1763. So these are probably apocryphal. His alleged participation in Pontiac's Rebellion from 1763 to 66 is also unverified, though he did take part in peace negotiations. Dunmore's War. Wow, I'm going to put
this. I've lost track of where we're at.
Cornstalk played a central role in Dunmore's War of 1774 after the 1768 Treaty of Fort Stanwix. Settlers and land speculators moved into the lands of South Ohio in present-day Kentucky. Although the Iroquois had agreed to cede the land, the Shawnee and others had not been present at the Fort Stanwix negotiations. They still claimed Kentucky as their hunting grounds. Clashes soon took place over this. Cornstalk tried unsuccessfully to prevent escalation of the hostilities.
Yeah, he was actually trying to remain neutral throughout the whole thing,
which is probably for the better, mm-hmm. not because of, picking one side, but just because that way you can help both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Attempting to block Virginian invasion of the Ohio country, Cornstalk led a force of Shawnee and Mingo warriors at the Battle of Point Pleasant. His attack, although ferociously made, was beaten back by the Virginians.
Okay, maybe he was neutral at the beginning.
Got there eventually.
Yep.
Cornstalk retreated and would reluctantly accept the Ohio River as the boundary of the Shawnee lands in the Treaty of Camp Charlotte. Cornstalk's commanding presence often impressed American colonials. A Virginia officer, Colonel Benjamin Wilson, wrote of Cornstalk's speech in the Lord Dunsmore Camp at Charlotte in 1774. I have heard the first orators in Virginia, Patrick Henry and Richard E. Lee, but have never heard one whose powers of delivery surpassed those of Cronstock on that occasion.
Let me correct you real quick. That was Richard Henry Lee.
Thank you.
It's okay. I know what you were thinking. This is the Revolutionary War, not the Civil War.
it's one of those days. American Revolution. With the American Revolution beginning, Cronstock worked to keep his people neutral. He represented the Shawnee at a treaty of councils in Fort Pitt in 1775 and 76, the first Native treaties were ever negotiated by the United States. Many Shawnee, nevertheless, hoped to use the British aid to reclaim their lands lost to settlers. By the winter of 1776, the Shawnee were effectively divided into a neutral faction led by Cronstock and militant bands led by men such as Blue Jacket. In the fall of 77, Cronstock made a diplomatic visit to Fort Randolph, an American fort at present-day Port Pleasant, seeking, as always, to maintain the faction's neutrality. Cronstock was detained by the fort commander, who decided on his own initiative to take a hostage and any Shawnees who fell into his hands. When, on November 10th, an American militiaman from the fort was killed nearby by an unknown native, angry soldiers brutally executed Cronstock, his son, Elinipsko.
Elinipsko. Elinipsko.
Two other Shawnee. American political and military leaders were alarmed by the murder of Cronstock, and they believed it was their only hope of securing Shawnee neutrality. At the insistence of Patrick Henry, the governor of Virginia, Cornstalk's killers, whom Henry called vile assassins, were eventually brought to trial. But since their fellow soldiers would not testify against them, all were acquitted.
And before you go any further, I just want to apologize to any of our Shawnee listeners out there. We're working very hard not to butcher the names.
Which is very bad.
If you can reach out and tell me how to pronounce the names, mm-hmm. I'd be eternally grateful, because I don't like butchering the names, but I butcher names.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Unfortunately.
No one's perfect, Ruthie.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Please continue.
In 1840, Cronstock's grave was rediscovered and his remains were moved to the Mason County courthouse grounds. In 1954, the courthouse was torn down and he was reburied in Port Pleasant National Park to Endy Way Park at the junction of Ohio and Kanawha Rivers. Debunking the curse. This alleged curse was actually created in 1921 when a fictional outdoor play was held at Point Pleasant, West Virginia. The play was based on the town's history with the dramatized and fictionalized elements. In the play, Cornstalk says, "I came to the fort as your friend, and you murdered me. You have murdered by my side my young son, and for this, may the curse of the Great Spirit rest upon this land. May it be blighted by nature. May it be blighted in its hopes. May the strength of its peoples be paralyzed by the stain of our blood." No historical source mentions any such utterance by Cornstalk, and the history of this 200-year curse was then passed down from generation to generation through oral storytelling, despite it being being information of a fictionalized play. The story was finally debunked and the transcript in the play was discovered.
And yet that curse is very apropos for the area.
Because, like a tulpa, it now has its own life mm-hmm. and its own power.
Yep. Oh, and by the way, the whole pronunciation, I mean, come on, folks, we have trouble with English.
Yes.
It's our native language and we have trouble speaking it. So, apologies.
You don't mean to be a terrible enunciationalist, but I'm a terrible enunciationalist.
So would you like to talk about our next subject?
The debunking?
No. Where
am I?
Woodrow.
Woodrow Derenberger.
Where is that?
We're after debunking the curse.
Five. After?
Yes.
Ah, there it is. Sorry, I hadn't gone far enough.
Sorry, folks. We're just getting Adrian up to speed here.
Woohoo! Speed!
Woodrow Derenberger and the legend of the Indrid Cold?
Yep.
The initial encounter. Excuse me. Woodrow Derenberger was a typical Appalachian man and a salesman for a sewing machine company who lived in Mineral Wells, West Virginia on Wednesday, November 2nd, 1966, about 7:30 p.m. while returning from Marietta, Ohio to his home, he had a strange experience. He was driving in his red panel truck on Route 77 in Parksburg, West Virginia. He claimed that he saw a flying metallic cigar-shaped craft. The ship traveled right by his truck and blocked the roadway ahead and gradually made him slow down to a stop on the side of the road. Woodrow also described the vehicle as resembling a kerosene lamp chimney. The aircraft was hovering about 12 inches off the road. A door opened on the craft and a being exited the ship, and the door shut with a loud thunk behind him. Later, the vehicle climbed about 50 feet into the air above the highway. The being walked right up to Derenberger's truck window. Derenberger described the being as looking like any ordinary man off the street, 6 foot tall, about 35 years of age, olive complexion, dark brown hair, and wearing a glossy metallic dark blue coat. The man spoke to Woodrow telepathically. His mouth did not move. Instead, he had a fixed smile on his face. The man looked in through the truck's window and said without saying anything, "Roll down your window. I want to talk to you." During their communication, the man called himself Indrid Cold. He told Woodrow that he meant him no harm. He looked perfectly natural and normal as any human being. Derenberger told Ronald Maines during an interview with WTAP-TV in Parkersburg, West Virginia, the day after the encounter. His face looked like he had a good tan, a deep suntan. He was not too dark, but it was just like he had been out in the sun a lot and had a good tan. His hair was combed straight back, and it was dark brown, and he seemed to have a good, thick head of hair. His eyebrows, his face, his features were very normal. I don't believe that he looked any different from any other man that you would meet on the street.
Something that's not listed here that I wanted to point out to you from some stuff I had heard, that when Indrid slammed the door on his ship, Woodrow noticed that the door kind of looked like a screen door. Now think about that, a screen door on a spacecraft.
Winnebago.
Kind of like a screen door on a submarine, right?
Yeah.
Winnebago.
Anyway,
sorry.
Please continue. I'm sorry.
Bad choice. Hold on.
But he wasn't normal.
Did you meet on the street?
No, it went down. It skipped down for some reason.
Okay.
That's why I was like, I've already read that.
Sorry about the silence, folks. We're working it out.
Figure out.
Do you see the part that says, but he wasn't normal? That was your next sentence.
No. It skipped. I'm wondering.
We are now on page 7.
That does me no good on my phone.
Would you like me to pick up where you left off?
No, I would like you to find it for me and hand it to me.
Okay.
You got this.
Right there. There you go.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You were there.
I was?
Yes.
Well, you don't have glaucoma. Shut up. But he wasn't normal. Denenberger said he had a large grin and kept his arms folded with his hands up under his armpits. And though he spoke to Derenberger, his smile never moved. He spoke, Derenberger said telepathically. It was the famous Derenberger interview. He said, "I was very frightened, and as far as I can understand, this was all mental. There were not spoken words from him. I knew what he was asking me, but yet he stood there and his mouth didn't move. He had a smile on his face. He appeared very courteous and friendly. He asked me to roll the window on my right side down. On my right-hand side of my truck."
Told you English.
"And I done what he asked," Derenberger said during the interview. "And this man stood there and he first asked me what I was called. And I know he meant my name, and I told him my name. And he asked me, he said, 'Why are you frightened?' He said, 'Don't be frightened. We wish you no harm.' He said, 'We mean you no harm. We wish you only happiness.' And I told him my name. And when I told him my name, he said he was called Cold. Indrid Cold." And Mr. Derenberger's conversation lasted about 10 minutes. Cold told him, "We eat, we breathe, we sleep, we bleed. We bleed even as you do. Before returning to his flying craft, he said, "We will see you again." Derenberger later reported this event to the police. It was Derenberger's and the world's introduction to the entity known as Indrid Cold.
Okay, I'll continue on.
I can do it if you want me
to. I'll do it if you'd like. Here we go. Now we're going to go on to the media storm. Woodrow's story gained traction in the media, gaining news coverage and attention after the Parkersburg police were convinced of his story. A representative of the Air Force even contacted him soon after his accounts were documented. On November 3rd, 1966, during his media storm, he went on live TV in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where he was interviewed by the state police, the Wood County Airport, the city police, and representatives from the Dayton, Ohio Air Force Base. Excuse me. After the interview aired, an older man claimed that he too saw a figure matching the description of injured Colt on Route 77 trying to flag him down, but he was afraid to stop. Derenberger's conversation with Colt could be corroborated. Other people claimed to see lights and fluttering vehicles at the same instant on the road. There were several witnesses that reported seeing Woodrow Derenberger stopped on the highway talking to this man, and some even saw the flying craft parked on the road. Reports poured in of strange lights in the sky and beings, all at the same time, at the same place, on Highway I-77 on that night of November 2nd, 1966. It was big news in the area. For almost 3 weeks, the Parkersburg News chronicled Derenberger's story and a number of forthcoming witnesses, many of whom asked to remain anonymous or have their names withheld. John Keel talked with Woodrow Derenberger and conducted his own interview and investigation. Gray Barker, a science fiction writer from Braxton County, West Virginia, also talked with Woodrow. Over the course of the month that followed, Derenberger claimed he was visited by Indrid Cold many times, and that he even took him on a spaceship to his planet. Indrid Cold would also appear at Woodrow's front door. His wife and children even knew that this Indrid Cold was paying him visits, and they even eventually came forward saying they too saw Indrid Cold and other strange beings. Woodrow's wife was terrified and stated that these beings were much like us, traveled in everyday cars, dressed in everyday clothes, but were not human in origin. There was even one time where Mr. Derenberger disappeared for 6 months and said he was with Indrid Cold. This is what members of his family actually believed. He would also receive mental messages from his long-distant friend. They would come suddenly and leave piercing migraine headaches. I wonder what his wife was thinking about him being gone for 6 months.
How are you going to pay the bills?
I know what my wife would think. I'd come home and find I can't get the door unlocked. So his residents would often receive strange unknown phone calls. Sometimes they were threats to stop speaking about his experience. Other times they were odd beeps and electronic hums. Sometimes it was just silence. The family changed their number to an unlisted one, but somehow their calls continued. Quick question. And this is just something I was thinking about today too. Mm-hmm. If you were told not to talk about something like that, what would your reaction be? Would you talk, or would you?
He was told not to talk.
Yeah.
By who? He got phone calls. Random phone calls saying "don't talk." Then I'm not going to trust a random phone call as much as I'm going to trust someone in my face saying, uh-huh, "I am John Q. Public."
Right.
But do you see the men in black suit? You see the government vehicle? Yes, sir. I will shut up now, sir.
And see, that's what I'm saying. Have you ever read or seen any incidents with men in black or military coming to talk to somebody where something did happen to them because they spoke? I was thinking about it. I can't think
only
of a single
TV
one.
Shows.
Yeah, I can't think of a single incident where anything happened to an eyewitness.
Only in TV shows, but that's, you know, yeah, no.
At least the ones who said something.
Yes.
Anyway, so his story gained such media attention that locals would flock to his house at all hours of the day and night and wait in crowds in his driveway to catch a glimpse of his friend Indrid Cold. That's got to be terrible. Bogle Ridge is another location associated with the story.
Who was telling him not to say anything?
Just voices on a telephone.
He doesn't know. So it wasn't like Indrid Cold telling him not to say anything.
No. Derenberger claimed to go there to meet with Indrid Cold and go on rides into outer space. Some locals claim to actually have seen spaceships land there, and that would be, again, Bogle Ridge. On one occasion, two men armed with loaded rifles were hiding in the woods by Derenberger's property. They observed a black Volkswagen enter his front yard. A peculiar man dressed in all black suit with his tan skin exited and walked with Woodrow before leaving. The hunters were disappointed. They waited even longer, wanting to see something truly terrifying, but maybe they already had. Woodrow hadn't heard of the men in black, but after his visit, he was extremely frightened by them. Derenberger eventually decided to seek medical attention and the opinion of a Parkersburg psychiatrist. He not only leaves with a clean bill of health and absolutely no evidence of chemical imbalance or disruption, but his very doctor endures a reaction soon after their meeting. He's contacted in December by a most peculiar man, his name, Indrid Cold. Hmm. He doesn't reach out by phone, but telepathically. So here's Indrid Cold saying, leave Woody alone to this doctor. Or he's healthy, don't mess with him. Something like that.
He's fine, just ignore it.
As I put the finger to my temple and make the sign of the telepathic communication. Yes.
People can't see you.
That's what we're describing. Why do
they get described?
Finger to the temple.
Yes. So let's go on to the books. Woodrow Derenberger later related his stories to an author. In 1971, they published a book titled Visitors from Lanulos, which told of Woodrow's visits from Indrid Cold. The book contained a foreword dated October 12, 1968 by John Keel. And I have an excerpt from his foreword. It says, there are many who will scoff at this book and reject it entirely. Woodrow Derenberger will be called a liar, a psychopath, and many other unpleasant things. He has already suffered considerable ridicule and condemnation, even from those who believe in flying saucers, but do not wish to believe that someone is actually riding around in them. I cannot endorse his story, but I do feel I know the man well enough to give him a character reference. The important thing is that he seems to be telling the truth as he knows it. He sincerely believes that these things happened to him, and he's willing to expose himself to ridicule and condemnation in order to make himself heard. I've talked to contactee claimants who are doctors, lawyers, newspapermen, police officers, and pilots. Woody has a lot of company, sane, reputable people. Perhaps we are the ones who have been insane for ignoring them for so long. Strange, unbelievable things are now happening to people all over the world. By listening to the handful of courageous ones, like Woodrow Derenberger, we may at last gain some real insight into what is really behind the UFO phenomenon. I'm not asking you to believe any of it, but I am asking you to listen to what he has to say. Incredibly, though it may seem, it's very possible that these very same things could happen to you tomorrow. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun. Okay.
I need to watch that movie again. So
I need to see Belt. Yes. We need to see Belt again.
Actually, I think she was referring to Muppet Haunted Mansion.
Yes. That was good too, but we still need to, I need to see the Croods again with Belt.
So anyway, in 1975, John Keel published his book, Mothman Prophecies, which detailed his experiences in West Virginia investigating UFOs and the Mothman. The book mentions Woodrow Derenberger and his encounter with Indrid Cold, along with many other strange things that are said to have happened in West Virginia, 1966 and 1967. Woodrow's overall experience as a contactee didn't just negatively affect him, but his family and his closest friends also. It came by way of years of harassing phone calls, losing jobs, losing friends, people trespassing on his property, ridicule, embarrassment, painful headaches, and depression. He suffered a bitter divorce and had to move away from the area because of his notoriety. He would later tell how his writing would disappear from his locked house and letters he sent would never reach their destination. He felt he was being watched. He moved away to escape his past and lived elsewhere for a long time. Years later, he moved back to the area and passed away in 1990 at the age of 74. Derenberger never denied his earlier claims. He simply stopped discussing them. In 2020, the Mothman Prophecies movie loosely adapted John Keel's book. The film used the idea of Indrid Cold and even a character named Gordon that was based on Woodrow Derenberger.
Not 2002.
My
dyslexia
bad.
Dyslexia is fun.
Yes, it is.
Recognition's a nut is a fish and a half.
Yes. The Woodrow Derenberger interview tape now sits in public view at the Mothman Museum. Glenn Wilson, who worked at WTAP-TV, had these reel-to-reel tapes for close to 30 years. He was going to throw them away on his retirement, but instead gave them to Susan Shepard, the creator of Haunted Parkersburg Ghost Tours, who loaned them to the museum. Pardon me. Excuse me. In 2011, a documentary called Eyes of the Mothman featured the Indrid Cold story. It told of Woodrow Derenberger's encounters, had Susan Shepard to comment on it, and even included a dramatization of the event. So now we got to get to the point of how Indrid Cold and the Mothman are actually connected, because these sound like two separate stories so far.
So far, yes, yeah. They do sound different. Or separate.
And here's the answer. Well, first of all, I'm going to say, before I start reading this, the encounter with Indrid Cold and the Mothman, the first encounter with the Mothman that's recorded is actually only a matter of about a week between these two events.
Okay.
Okay. So is that a connection? I don't know. But Andrew Cold is a mysterious figure often associated with UFO sightings and encounters. The Mothman is a cryptid reportedly seen in the Point Pleasant area of West Virginia in the 1960s. Some people believe that Andrew Cold may have been connected to the Mothman sightings due to reported encounters with individuals who fit his description around the same time and area. However, it's important to note that these connections are based on folklore and urban legends rather than concrete evidence. Both Andrew Cold and the Mothman remain subjects of fascination and speculation in the realm of paranormal and cryptozoology.
Excuse me, sorry.
So, Tracy, would you like to talk more about the history of the Mothman?
History and legend of the Mothman. On November 15th, 1966, two young couples from Point Pleasant, Roger and Linda Scarberry, and Steve and Mary Mallett, told police that they had seen a large black creature whose eyes glowed red, sitting at the side of the road near the TNT area, the site of a former World War II munitions plant. Linda Scarberry described it as a slender, muscular man about 7 foot tall, with white wings. However, she was unable to discern its face due to the hypnotic effect of its eyes. Distressed, the witnesses sped away, reporting that the creature flew after their car, making a screeching sound, pursued them as far as Point Pleasant city limits. Over the next few days, more people reported similar sightings after local newspapers covered it. Two volunteer firemen saw it and said it was a large bird with red eyes. Mason County Sheriff George Johnson believed the sightings were due to an unusually large heron he termed the Shite Poke. Contractor Noel Partridge told Johnson that when he aimed the flashlight at a creature in a nearby field, its eyes glowed like bicycle reflectors.
Now, here's something I wanted to point out, too. We're talking about the two couples that were chased by the Mothman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing it didn't say here that I know is that the Mothman actually kept speed with the vehicle.
Okay.
Or the creature. What, you know.
Yeah.
I won't call them Mothman yet because at this point they don't know. But it kept speed with the vehicle. I don't know if a crane could do that.
The processing of commercial information is complete. Back to the show.
If you're speeding away, I would guess not.
Furthermore, it was actually flying over the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Possible?
Keeping speed and flying over the vehicle.
Well, once I get to this section, I'll see if I can look at the flight speed of a crane. We'll see.
That sounds like the start of a bad Monty Python.
But I'm bumping.
Yeah. What is the airspeed of a...
of an unladen flying crane and a heron.
Unladen swallow.
Anywho.
I need to stop this for a second.
So anyway.
Sorry, I've lost count.
Additionally, he blamed the buzzing noises from his television set and the disappearance of his German Shepherd dog on this creature. Wildlife biologist Robert L. Smith at West Virginia University told reporters that descriptions and settings fit the sandhill crane, a large American crane almost as tall as a man with a 7 foot wingspan, reddish coloring around its eyes. The rib may have wandered out of its migration route and therefore was unrecognized at first because it's not native to the region. Due to its popularity of the Batman TV series at the time, the Adam West version,
yes,
the fictional superhero Batman and his rogues gallery were prominently featured in the public eye. While the villain Killer Moth did not appear on the show, the comic book influenced both him and Batman is believed to have some influence on the coinage of the name Mothman in the local newspapers. Following the December 15, 1967 collapse of the Silver Bridge and the death of 46 people, the incident gave rise to the legend and connected the Mothman sightings and the bridge collapse. According to the Georgian newspaper...
Georgian.
Well, it's underlined there for it's wrote up, and then you have the Georgian newspaper Svobodnaya Gruzia. Russian ufologists claimed that Mothman sightings in Moscow foreshadowed the 1999 Russian apartment bombings.
Let me just say, I'm sorry, Tracy. You seem to be getting all
the names.
All the fun names, yep.
I just want to see how much more gray hair I can get by tripping over my tongue. Anywho.
Your hair has grown out nicely.
Apologies to our Russian listeners.
Kel, if you're listening, I am so sorry. Anywho. The Mothman Prophecies 2002 is a major motion picture loosely based on the 1975 book the same name by John Keel. In 2016, WCHS-TV published a photo purported to be of Mothman taken by an anonymous man while driving Route 2 in Mason County. Science writer Sharon A. Hill proposed that the photo showed a bird, perhaps an owl, carrying a frog or snake away, and wrote that there's zero reason to suspect that the Mothman is described in legend. There is zero reason to suspect it is the Mothman as described in legend. There are too many far more reasonable explanations. Now I have to stop because I use suspect to suspect, and we know that American language has where you put the enunciation or the heaviness is verb or noun. So I apologize. Exactly.
That's okay. yeah, I've seen that photo actually. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's a shadowy photo. You don't see any definition. It just looks like a shadow in the air of a flying creature with what looks like these long legs hanging out behind it. So it looks kind of manlike.
I have a memory of it, but it's not.
But I have to agree. If you look at this photo closely, it looks like a bird carrying something in its feet, like a snake or something like that. It's just the fact that the snake is kind of curled around and the distance from head to tail is about even as it's being dragged away. So it kind of looks like it could be feet, but it doesn't look, the legs don't look real to me.
Okay.
So I'm going to call animal on that one too.
So the analysis. Folklorist Jan Harold, let's try that again. Folklorist Jan Harold Brunvand notes that the Mothman has been widely covered on popular press, with some claiming sightings connected to the UFOs, others suggesting the military storage site of this Mothman's home. Brunvand notes that the recountings of the 1966 and 67 Mothman. Notes the recountings of 1966-67 Mothman reports usually state that at least 100 people saw Mothman and many more afraid to report their sightings. However, he points out that these written sources for such stories consist of children's books or sensationalized or undocumented accounts that fail to quote identifiable persons. Grundavid found elements in common among many Mothman reports, such as older folk tales, suggesting that something real may have triggered the scares and become woven in existing folklore. He also records anecdotal tales of Mothman supposedly attacking the roofs of parked cars that were occupied by teenagers. Mm-hmm. English should not be that hard to read.
No.
Conversely, Joel Nichols says that the number of hoaxes followed by the publicity generated by the original reports, such as a group of construction workers who tied flashlights to helium balloons. Nichols attributes the Mothman stories to sightings of barred owls, suggesting that Mothman's glowing eyes are actually the red eye effect caused by a reflection of light from flashlights or other bright light sources. Benjamin Redford points out that the only report of glowing red eyes was secondhand, that of Shirley Hensley quoting her father. One of the prevailing hypotheses associated with Mothman at the time of the original sightings was that it was a misidentified sandhill crane, due primarily to the size of the bird as well as the reddish flesh around the crane's eyes. Daniel A. Reed examined the migration patterns and historically reported sightings of the sandhill cranes in the area of Point Pleasant and proposed that in cases where the eye shining was noted, it was statistically more likely that a witness was seeing and misidentifying a great blue heron instead.
Now, let's stop there real quick. Eye shine on an animal, what color is it usually?
It depends on the animal.
Mm-hmm. It does, but...
Because it can be red, it can be white, it can be green.
Amber.
Can be amber.
Amber's not red. There are differences between red and amber. Yes,
but bright red glowing eyes, you don't really see that in an animal.
Not unless it's an albino animal.
Yes. True. Then you'll see, yeah. Or Isis.
Well, her eye shine's not red either.
Yes, it is. Her eye shine is red. She's got blue eyes and her eye shine is red.
Okay.
Cool. It is red. Trust me.
It's still an albinoism.
Yeah, but
blue
she's...
eyes has less pigmentation all the way around the eye, and because of the less pigmentation,
but definitely she is not an albino. Mm-hmm. She is anything but.
Well,
she's gotten darker as she got older.
All I can say though is if the eyes are glowing red eyes.
I talk good English, don't I?
Sorry. But if the eyes are supposed to be glowing red eyes, the sandhill crane has a red ring around its eyes. It doesn't glow.
Their eyes might actually glow, and glowing with the round around the face might actually help. I don't know.
Well, from what I understand, Sandhill's eye shine is not red.
What color is it?
I want to say it's kind of a yellowish white, if memory serves.
Well, then again, if you're in a stressful situation, ask my mother about this. When you see something to get you wigged out, you will see, say, the closing scene of Dracula, the black and white movie on the big screen, the silver screen, and Dracula has red eyes because he scares the bejeebus out of you.
Even though it's a black and white
film. Even though it's a black and white film, there was no red eyes at all.
Well, I actually saw an experiment where they had people driving through Point Pleasant, and they had put these little mock-up statues of the Mothman in the areas where they were driving.
Like the umbrella?
Yeah, but the reason behind it was to see what they would describe when seeing the Mothman as far as its height would go. And to a person, they could not accurately describe what they saw.
This is true. Well, heck, they've proven it multiple times with police in action situations.
Mm-hmm.
You have 10 witnesses. You have 10 different stories. You have one person who did it all, and they tracked it. This is the person who's doing it. But you have 10 different descriptions because they're cutting into different things, different situations, and what they're feeling.
Yes.
So,
and a lot of that is feeling.
Very fallible.
Humans are crummy eyewitnesses.
Human fallible. Human memory is stupid. It really is. We do our best to remember. Sometimes we get flashes and we can remember things, but a lot of times, especially over time, memories fade.
Yep.
Okay, now I'm sad.
Memories fade?
Yeah.
Okay.
So doesn't it suck to get old?
Should I continue?
Please do. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sidetrack. It was a question I wanted to bring up.
Yay, sidebar!
Well, I wanted your opinions on eyeshine. You know?
I get that.
Okay.
So according to University of Chicago, psychologist David A. Gallo, 55 settings of Mothman in Chicago during the 2017. Quote, 55 settings of Mothman in Chicago during 2017. End quote. I'm tripping my tongue up today.
It's okay.
Published on the website of self-described Freudian researcher Lon Strickler, R.A., quote, selective sample. Gallo explains that he's not sampling random people and asking if they saw Mothman. He's just counting the number of people who voluntarily came forward to report a sighting. According to Gallo, people are more likely to visit paranormal-centric websites like Strickler's might also be more inclined to believe in. Therefore, the witness of existence, witness in the existence of a Mothman, in quotes. Some ufologists, paranormal authors, and cryptozoologists suggest that Mothman might be an alien, a supernatural manifestation, or a previously unknown species of animal. In his 1975 book, Keel claimed that Point Pleasant residents experienced precognitions, including premonitions of the collapse of the Silver Bridge, UFO sightings, visit from inhuman or threatening men in black, and other phenomena. Festival and statues. No, we're not going to do this. Stop. There we go.
Would you like someone else to take over?
Nah, I'm good.
Okay.
I am mean and terrible. Ha ha. Point Pleasant held its first annual Mothman Festival in 2002. At the time the movie came out, sorry. The Mothman Festival began after brainstorming creative ways to attract visitors to Point Pleasant. The group organized the event, chose the Mothman to be the center of the festival due to its uniqueness, and as a way to celebrate the local legacy in its town.
You know, actually, I think it started after the movie came out. I think the movie was kind of a catalyst for the event, too.
Let's run with it! Yeah!
Yeah, pretty much.
According to the event organizer, Jeff Wamsley, the average attendance for Mothman Festival is estimated 10,000 to 12,000 people per year. A 12-foot-tall metallic statue of the creature, created by artist and sculptor Rob Roach, was unveiled in 2003.
Which looks nothing like the actual descriptions of the Mothman.
Yes, this is true.
It's his artistic rendering.
It reminds me more of Killer Moth from Batman.
What?
He gives me, not the Tick, but you know, the series of Tick. He gives me that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anywho. The Mothman Museum and Research Center opened in 2005. The festival is held the third weekend of every September, hosting great guest speakers, vendor exhibits, pancake eating contests, and hayride tours of local notable areas.
Because that has everything to do with Mothman,
what
right?
What does pancakes have to do with Mothman?
See? Yes, see? That's
pancakes and Easter I get. Okay, pancakes and Good Friday I get, but anywho, that's another story.
No, but you see, I was thinking the exact same thing, Tracy. I'm like, what does that have to do? That's, you know.
The Silver Bridge. Am I continuing or someone else reading it?
Let's give this one to Adri.
Okay, just a second.
Now she got to find it again. Dun, dun, dun!
Aha!
She found it.
That wasn't that far away. The Silver Bridge was an I-bar chain suspension bridge built in 1928, which carried U.S. Route 35 over the Ohio River, connecting Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and Gallipolis, Ohio. Officially named the Point Pleasant Bridge. It was popularly known as the Silver Bridge for the color of its aluminum paint. Hold on one second. Excuse me. On December 15th, 1967, the Silver Bridge collapsed amid heavy rush hour traffic, resulting in deaths of 46 people, two of whom were never found. Investigation of the wreckage soon pointed to the failure of a single eye bar in one of the suspension chains as the primary cause, a finding noted in the preliminary report released within 10 months of the collapse. However, to explain why that eye bar failed, a fatigue triggered by a flaw just 0.1 inches, 2.5 millimeters deep, which led to a fracture required significantly more time and effort to uncover with the final accident report, taking 3 years to complete. The collapse led, to significant changes in the way bridges in the U.S. are inspected and maintained. The collapsed bridge was replaced by the Silver Memorial Bridge, which was completed in 1969. A history of I-bar chain bridge construction.
Now it gets a little boring, folks.
Sorry.
Sorry, but it should be included.
At the time of the Silver Bridge construction, I-bar bridges had been built for about 100 years. Such bridges had usually been constructed from redundant bar links using rows of 4 to 6 bars, sometimes using several such chains in parallel. An example can be seen in the Clifton Suspension Bridge designed by Isambard Kingdom Brunel, having chain eye bars that are redundant in two dimensions. This early suspension bridge is still in service. Other bridges of similar design, including the earlier road bridge over the Menai Strait built by Thomas Telford in 1826. The Széchenyi chain bridge in Budapest, built in 1839 to 1849, destroyed in the closing days of World War II by retreating Germans in 1945, and rebuilt identically by 1949 with the redundant chains and hangars, and the Three Sisters, three self-anchored suspension bridges in Pittsburgh of similar design and construction period from 1924 to 28, each with suspension chains consisting of at least 8 eye bars per link. Should I keep going?
Yep.
Silver bridge structure. Low redundancy, high strength. The eye bars in the Silver Bridge offered little to no redundancy, as each chain link consisted of just 2 eye bars in parallel. Each bar was 45 to 55 feet long and 2 inches thick. Bars were joined together at the eye holes using cylindrical pins, 11.5 inches in diameter. These eye bars were made of a new higher strength steel and more than twice the tensile strength of other steels of that era, which means fewer eye bars per link were needed to achieve the required strength to support the bridge. Earlier, such bridges often used 4 or more eye bars per link. However, with only 2 eye bars per link, the failure of one of them would hugely increase the load on the other, making failure of a suspension chain and the collapse of the entire bridge far more likely. Yeah, that makes sense.
So it was bound to happen.
Yeah, sounds like it.
A little stress fracture and the bridge collapses.
Mm-hmm. Accident investigators found that
had there been
3 or 4 more eye bars per link, there would have been the possibility that the failure of one bar would not have led to the disaster.
So like with the other bridges, they all have redundant eye bars. So should one stress break, they're still supported by the other eye bars.
Yeah.
The Silver Bridge didn't have that sort of support.
By comparison, the Brooklyn Bridge used suspension cables made up of thousands of individual wires, each to provide the cable a relatively high safety factor of 6. Such a cable also had an extremely high level of redundancy, with the failure of a single wire having almost no effect on its overall strength. During the Brooklyn Bridge's construction, it was discovered that some substandard steel wire had been installed in the cables. To compensate, 150 more good steel wires were added to each cable, supplementing each's 5,434 wires. The designer's son, Washington Roebling, decided the safety factor may have been reduced, but remained more than sufficient.
So I'm assuming what they're talking about is a cable of wound steel wires.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've actually seen some of the wires that they had been not necessarily specifically for the bridges, but that they use for the suspension bridges cut open. And you see all, it's like so many
in each cable. A cable that is a multiple cable of a multiple cable.
And that's, really, and that's really your redundancy.
Each cable has a bunch, and then each one has a bunch. Right, yeah, it's so a lot.
One of those little cables should snap, the bridge is still supported.
Yes.
But when you see one go, you replace the whole treatment mesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quickly.
But you're able to do that because of all the redundancy built into the cable.
This is true.
Okay.
By comparison, the Brooklyn Bridge used suspension cables made up of thousands of individual. Wait, did I already do that?
You need to go to Rocker Towers.
Okay, I didn't know I had been. Okay, it slipped again. Rocker Towers, the two towers that supported the two suspension chains, rose nearly 131 feet, 40 meters, from the bridge's main piers. They featured a rocker design which allowed them to tilt slightly at their bases in response to unbalanced loads on the bridge or to changes in chain length due to temperature. Yeah, gets cold, it tightens. So
and expands
in the heat. Expands in the heat, yeah. So makes sense. I've lost my train of thought. Hold on.
Dun, dun, dun.
She sidetracked herself.
Prior to their use on the Silver Bridge, rocker towers had been used on a similar bridge in Brazil and before that on two large bridges in Europe. Although the rocker towers required the bridge's suspension chains to keep them upright, their ability to tilt allowed the towers to minimize bending stresses, which standard fixed base towers must be designed to resist, resulting in a simpler tower design that used less material than fixed towers and cost significantly less to build. Early into the collapse investigation, the rocker towers provided a significant clue as to the failure's cause and location. Investigators noticed that both towers had fallen during the collapse, a strong indication that a suspension chain had broken. Since neither tower could stand upright without the support of intact chains, the towers themselves showed no sign of failure, and the fact that both fell eastward toward the West Virginia side clearly indicated a chain breaking occurring somewhere west of the tower on the western side, i.e. Ohio side, of the bridge. By contrast, a chain breaking occurring, say, in the center part of the span would have resulted in the towers collapsing in opposite direction away from each other. So they both went the same way, and they both went, yeah, okay. Should I keep going? Or do you want me to stop? Design loads. The bridge, which was designed in 1926-27, generally conformed to the engineering standards of its era. According to the investigation into the bridge's collapse and the investigation's review of the original stress calculations underlying the design found no significant errors. A few years earlier in 1923, AASHO, a national standards settings organization, had released documentation to aid engineers in designing bridges, providing quality control specifications and guidelines on topics such as computing forces and loads, types of properties in steel, and estimating future levels. The bridge's I-bars, which used to a new stronger steel, offered a maximum allowable stress of 50,000 psi, significantly higher than most other steels in use. And the bridge had a design safety factor of 1.50 within engineering norms. Investigators into the collapse found no indication that the bridge had been overloaded even on the day it failed, despite the bridge's age and the heavy traffic on it at the time of the collapse. The load it was carrying was found to be within its normal capacity, and the location where the failure occurred was at less than half the maximum live load it was designed to handle when the collapse began. Wreckage analysis. The bridge failure was due to a defect in a single link known as I-bar 330 on the north of the Ohio subsidiary chain and the first link below the top of the Ohio tower. A small crack was formed through fretting wear at the bearing and grew through internal corrosion, a problem known as stress corrosion cracking. The crack was only about 0.1 inches, 2.5 millimeters deep when the link failed, breaking in a brittle fashion.
So it was already starting to break. The corrosion gets into it and opens that crack up even more.
Actually, what they mean by the corrosion, if I think I'm understanding it, they mean it rubs on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rubbing on itself internally, and that's how it cracked. It was an internal, because things go bouncing over the bridge, and then the eye bars and everything, they rub on each other inside. Yeah. So that's what the corrosion, what they mean by the corrosion. If I'm guessing.
Sounds logical.
That's where my head went. Anyway, I've got.
And then add in, because it was November, yes. So you've cold. Got cold, you've got rain, you've got possibility of
snow.
Possibly snow, but you've got ice formation at the very least.
And then when it
gets wet, it
could drip in.
Yeah.
So it's probably both.
Got a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
It makes it
a
foosh.
By going still?
Yes. Yeah.
When the lower side of the eye bar failed, all the load was transferred to the other side of the eye bar, which then failed by ductile overload. The joint was then held together only by three eye bars, and another slipped off the pin at the center of the bearing, so the chain was completely severed. A collapse of the entire structure was inevitable, since all parts of the suspension bridge are in equilibrium with one another. If something goes, everything goes.
Yep.
That makes plenty of sense.
So like I said, it was inevitable. It was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised it didn't happen sooner, to be completely honest, somewhere else.
A lot of that is because the bridge wasn't inspected prior to that.
No, it was. They just didn't find anything wrong.
Right.
With
it was because
you can't see the inside of something.
Right. It was a tiny little stress fracture. Had they actually
2.5 millimeters or 2.55 millimeters, teeny tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Inspector X. Okay. Yeah. So you just took my thunder there. There you go.
Well, it says here the damaged link would have been difficult to see during inspection of the bridge.
Yes. That was exactly what I was.
Mm-hmm.
Inspection prior to construction would not have been able to notice the tiny crack. The only way to detect the fracture would have been to disassemble the eye bar. The technology used for inspection at the time was not capable of detecting such cracks. Should I keep going or should I be done?
The bridge is all yours.
Okay. Aftermath. The collapse focused much-needed attention on the condition of older bridges, leading to intensified inspection protocols and numerous eventual replacements. There were only two bridges built to a similar design, one upstream at St. Mary's, West Virginia, and the notably longer Hercílio Luz Bridge at Florianópolis, Brazil. There's a lot of these bridges like that in Brazil still. Sorry, we've been talking about the suspension bridges in Brazil.
Yep, and they're holding up.
The St. Mary's Bridge was immediately closed to traffic and was demolished by the state in 1971. A small truss bridge remained to allow access to the island in the river. The High Carpenter Memorial Bridge was later built to replace the demolished bridge. The Hercílio Luz Bridge remained in active service until 1991, although both it and the Silver Bridge use the same types of high-strength steel for the eye bars, it was built to a higher safety factor than the West Virginia Bridge, and the greater redundancy with each suspension chain using an array of four eye bars per link. That's actually a lot, compared to just the two per link to the Silver Bridge. But in 1991, the Florianópolis Bridge was closed due to high levels of corrosion. Following extensive renovations, it reopened in December 2019. Modern non-destructive testing methods allowed some of the older bridges to remain in service, but with tighter weight restrictions. Most heavily used bridges of this type have been replaced with bridges of more modern design. The collapse inspired legislation to ensure that older bridges were regularly inspected and maintained. However, aging infrastructure is still a problem in the United States, everywhere. Mm-hmm. In 1983, the Mianus River Bridge in Greenwich, Connecticut collapsed, causing the deaths of three drivers. That's very low death rate, I'm sorry. In 2007, it's sad, but it's not. I mean, 49 people died in the Silver.
It was a slow morning or evening.
Anyway, sorry, collapsed. Three drivers in 2007, the I-35W Mississippi River Bridge disaster in Minneapolis, Minnesota, resulted in 13 deaths in early September 2009. The failure of an eye bar in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge was discovered during a scheduled closure, resulting in an emergency repair to reinforce. I remember that. It was very hush-hush, but I remember it leaked at one point. Do you remember that?
No.
You don't remember that bridge? It's part of why we have a new bridge.
I know that it was having issues, but I remember the bridge. I just don't remember the actual issue.
A memorial was installed in Point Pleasant to commemorate the 46 bridge collapse victims. A scale model, and two of which they never found, A scale model of the original Silver Bridge was on display at the Point Pleasant River Museum. An archive of literature about the bridge was also kept there for public inspection. On the lower ground floor, the museum displayed an I-bar assembly from the original bridge. The museum closed on July 1st, 2018 due to significant fire damage. The future of the Silver Bridge exhibit is not known. Another I-bar example has been erected for public viewing at a small rest area on the Ohio side of the river along Route 7. The bridge has been designated as a National Historic Civil Engineering Landmark by the American Society of Civil Engineers, as its collapse ultimately led to the creation of the first National Bridge Inspection Program and the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1968.
So even though disaster hit, the bridge collapsed, it's still something good still came out of it.
Yes.
Sadly,
it takes something like this for something better to come out of it.
But this is a global thing, because mm-hmm. we're talking about European bridges that were built the same way that have been revamped and done at Brazil and all this. So this is as sad as it is, it's stopped other things like this happening. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So please continue.
Okay.
Said the bridge is all yours.
Yeah. Legacy. Reviewing the collapse and the subsequent investigation in his 2012 book, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, engineering historian Henry Petrosky finds it a cautionary tale for engineers of every kind. As a result of the thoroughness of the investigation, the cause of the disaster was precisely and indisputably found to be a design that inadvertently made inspection all but impossible and failure all but inevitable. If ever a design was to blame for a failure, this was it. Petrosky does not fault the bridge's designers, who were unaware of many of these hazards. Instead, he points to the future. If there is anything positive about the Silver Bridge failure, he concludes, is that its legacy should be to remind engineers to proceed always with the utmost caution, ever mindful of the possible existence of unknown unknowns and the potential consequences of even the smallest design decisions. Am I keep going?
Unless you would like one of us to take over for you.
No,
your turn.
Okay.
Okay, fine.
You.
So in his 1970 book,
I'm not upset.
In his 1970 book, Operation Trojan Horse, in his 1975 book, The Mothman Prophecies, Fordian author John Keel linked the Silver Bridge collapse to alleged sightings of the Mothman. Here's why we talk about the Silver Bridge collapse at that time. The story was adapted as a film by the same name, released in 2002. Author Jack Matthews wrote a novella, Beyond the Bridge, written as the diary of an imaginary survivor of the disaster, starting a new life as a dishwasher in a tiny West Virginia town. Honky-tonk singer-songwriter and West Virginia native Ray Anderson released The Silver Bridge Disaster as the A-side of a 1967 single. Yes?
Were there any survivors on this bridge collapse, or did everybody who went in on it go?
There were survivors, yes.
You don't hear about who survived. You just said there were so many deaths.
Well, the bridge collapsed, but not to such a degree that the entire bridge fell.
The two towers both fell.
Yes, but if you look at pictures of the bridge, the towers fell east toward the west side of the river.
Toward the Virginia side, and that means that
there was
something
significant damage to the
side,
bridge. Yeah. Yes, but there were still pieces of the bridge that were being held in suspension. So, vehicles on the bridge on either side were still, for lack of a better term, safe.
Okay. Well, no, I just wanted to know. I'm sorry I interrupted. Keep going.
So let's see. Where was I here? Silver Memorial Bridge is a cantilever bridge that spans the Ohio River between Gallipolis, Ohio, and Henderson, West Virginia. The bridge was completed in 1969 as a replacement for the collapsed Silver Bridge. Although it is located about 1 mile or 1.6 kilometers downstream south of the original. Bridge carried U.S. 35 cross river and serves as a major crossing for people and goods traveling between Charleston, West Virginia, and southern and central Ohio. The speed limit on the bridge is 65 miles per hour, 105 kilometers per hour. No toll is imposed on either end.
Which is weird because they're toll bridges all over the East Coast.
Now, as far as the connection with the Mothman, like we were talking about, it's because Keel said that there were sightings of the Mothman on the bridge.
Beforehand, yes.
And if you look on the internet, you'll see photos, hopefully not doctored, of what looks like a shadowy figure.
Maybe hiding, the Mothman carried off the
sitting
people
on
they
top.
Couldn't find.
Yeah, but it's sitting on top of one of the towers of the bridge.
Sorry, you didn't hear that.
No, because I'm trying to speak and you went and you talked over me.
I didn't talk over you. You actually quietly said what I said.
But anyway, yeah, the Mothman, there's a shadowy figure sitting on top of one of the towers of the Silver Bridge. And if you can believe the movies, which I really can't say you can, there was people who said that they had premonitions of the bridge collapsing. That someone had, you know, in their thoughts said, you know, the bridge is going to collapse. Take that with a grain of salt, though. It was from the
hindsight.
Movie. Yeah. Suppose, you know, in the movie, Andrew Cold contacted John Klein, which was actually John Keel, to inform him that the bridge was going to collapse.
Take with it, as you will, this grain of salt.
Oh, definitely grain of salt with that. There is nothing in the reports that say that Andrew Cold told anybody about the bridge collapse. So, sorry.
Did you get in trouble?
I almost got in trouble.
Don't get in trouble. I have to go home in a few minutes. Don't get in trouble.
Set.
Okay, that's going to do it for tonight, folks. Anything else you guys like to say before we call it quits for the night?
We have now talked about the Mothman in more than a 5-second spurt.
This is true. We have brought up the Mothman before, just kind of in passing.
As a bit and piece, not a proper talking do. So we talking dude.
Yes, we talking dude.
Nothing else right
dude.
Now. Talking dude.
So anyway, the only thing left to say, of course, is if you enjoyed the show, you'd like to contact us and talk about it, or if you have a show idea of your own, or if you've had an encounter you want to talk about, any sort of encounter, doesn't matter what it is. You know, so long as it's paranormal. I don't want to hear about some weird guy on your porch. Although it might be a good story too. It could be a paranormal weird guy on your porch. But if you got a story like that or you want to share or just talk to us and say hi, you can contact us at our What in the Podcast Facebook group, the What in the Podcast Facebook group. You can contact Tracy, Adriana, or myself on our own pages as well.
I will try to be better about checking it.
Wait. I do have something to add to this. I got it finally. The airspeed velocities of a sandhill crane and of a gray heron. Are you ready?
Sure, why not?
The sandhill crane is an average of 25 to 35 mile per hour. Okay? But the great heron has a 24 mile per hour range, but can go from 9 to 60 miles per hour.
So it's a possibility.
So it's a possibility
okay.
that the great heron could have pounded that car.
They could have thought the car was something interesting
to look
at. But
not the sandhill crane, which is everybody's saying.
Not the sandhill crane, no.
Okay. Thank you for looking that up, Tracy.
Like I said, finally here. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
All righty. So anyways, I was saying you can contact us on our Facebook page links. You can also send a message via the link to the podcast you are listening to right now. Just look down in the description. You'll find the link below. Or you can email us at the What in the Podcast Facebook group. I just blew that. What in the Podcast Facebook group is our Facebook page. You want to contact us via email at whatinthepodcast@gmail.com. Did I leave anything out? Did I trip anything up besides that?
Other than us tripping over our tongues? No, I think we're good tonight. Yep.
Train of thought derails on a regular basis. You know how it is.
Back and not dying in the bedroom choking on my own saliva.
Nice to have you back without threatening murder upon me.
Butter. As gross as that sounds. But
didn't even hear me, did you?
What?
Nope.
I said it's nice to have you back without threatening murder upon me.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun.
Wait, the night is young.
Uh-huh.
But wait, there's more.
No, there isn't. This is it. We're done for the night. All we have left to say is everybody have a good night, stay spooky, and let's end the show by cueing the gremlin. What in the Podcast is a part of the What in the Podcast Network and is available on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other great podcast formats. You can find us on Facebook at the What in the Podcast Facebook group. If you have a great story idea or have a personal paranormal event that you want to share with us, email us at whatinthepodcast@gmail.com with your story, or you can leave us a voice message by clicking the link in the episode description. If you like what you're hearing, please don't forget to leave us a review and rate us 5 stars. It doesn't seem like much, but it helps us more than you can imagine. What in the Podcast is also made possible thanks to our sponsors and listeners like you. Thanks for listening.